before I invite John up to share the message with you, wanted to let you know to check out your Bibles. We're going to be looking at Luke today, Luke 7. It's also on the back of your worship guide if you want to look there. But we're going to actually be doing a kind of a reader's theater style. So I'd like to invite those that are helping to read today to come forward. If they want to just come to the mics here, that would be great. And also, I just want to take a moment and just acknowledge someone here. Despite she's wonderful, despite the fact that we were in college together, you will recognize we sing a song here that many of you are familiar with. It goes, "Open hearts, open minds." Yeah, you know that one? Carol's husband wrote that song. So thank you so much, because that has been a really important theme song for us that we really appreciate, and people belt it out. So thank you very much. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the Luke passage today, because it's one of these passages that before I knew this, I was always kind of curious. This is a passage where Jesus is invited to a meal with a Pharisee. And this Pharisee named Simon, it was probably a very fancy setting. And what happens in the middle of the meal is a woman comes in and she pours oil on Jesus' feet and washes his feet with her tears. And I don't know, when I, you know, hearing this story, I'm thinking, is she under the table? You know, I just couldn't figure that out. It just didn't jive with my understanding of a banquet. And then I learned that in the first century, the Romans ate at a thing called a triclinium. Tri means? And clinium means recline. So it's a three-sided sofa, basically, that you would recline on. And you'd usually lie on your left side. You'd, you know, put your left hand here. You wouldn't be using your left hand, because that was for personal hygienic purposes. You'd use your right hand to eat with. And so you'd reach over and you would eat that way. And so here's a picture right here that kind of represents that. And you can see the servants would be around on the outside behind, or maybe they'd come into the center in order to replenish the food or whatever. This was a really convenient way to be, because Roman meals would often go from, you know, mid-afternoon until late at night. So, I mean, I really think that's cool. You can kind of lay over and snooze a bit and go back to eating. I mean, what's not to like, you know? So this is the way they would do it. Here's another picture, kind of a modern take of some people enjoying that. But, I mean, just think about how different the dynamic would be at the dinner table. And it also helped me understand, you know, like in the passage where it says the disciple that Jesus loved put his head in Jesus' breast. You know, I'm trying to picture that one way or the other, but you can see now where it's like you just kind of roll over and there you are, you know? So it's a different way of understanding this story. I wanted to tell you about it because it's one of those things that separates us from the people who would have first heard this story, because our culture is so different. When you go up to Masada, for instance, and are looking down in the valley where the Romans had encamped for over a year to put a siege on Masada, you see the camps still in the desert. You see the walls of the camps still there. And in the center of every camp, down there on the floor of the desert, you can see the tricliniums of the legionnaires, because they built their tricliniums out of stone, which are still there 2,000 years later. I mean, this was a very typical way that Romans would share their meals with one another. And so before you heard this story today, I wanted to give you that kind of visual so you could get away from thinking of all this kind of going on underneath the table. So let's hear this story from Luke.
One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And a woman in the city, who was a sinner, having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. She stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to bathe his feet with her tears and to dry them with her hair. Then she continued kissing his feet and anointing them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw it, he said to himself,
"If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what kind of woman this is who is touching him, that she is a sinner."
Jesus spoke up and said to him,
Simon, I have something to say to you.
Teacher, speak.
A certain creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debts for both of them. Now, which one of them loved him more?
I suppose the one for whom he canceled the greater debt.
You have judged rightly.
Then, turning towards the woman, he said to Simon,
Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet. But she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she hasn't stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love. But the one to whom is little forgiven loves little.
Then he said to her,
Your sins are forgiven.
But those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, Who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman,
Your faith has saved you. Go in peace.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
I'm really delighted to be invited to come to this church. I've known David as I've known his colleague Jeff for a long while, and I was at Jeff's church, I think, 6-7 years ago, and I knew about Fountains, but to be here is just a great delight. Because I'm Scottish, people presume a great deal, including because I come from the nation that invented golf, that I'll play golf and that I'll tell golf stories. Well, I don't either play golf or tell golf stories. The same way people presume that because I'm a pastor, I might tell pastor stories, but I really get fed up with them because they're incestuous. They're all about a professor who I sat under, or, you know, a minister who I was a friend with, or what happened in another congregation. So I'm being quite exceptional to myself this morning by telling a pastor story, but it's something which has been in my mind since I met this person. Now, in case people go online to try and trail through where I've been in North America in the past 4 weeks, I should let you know that I've probably spoken to about 250 pastors, so the chances of you finding this man are very slim. So I'm going to call him Alan, which is not his proper name, but it's a convenient name. And he told me this story about himself, of how he had grown up in a family where his father was a leading pathologist. And the father was a very good father. He wanted to encourage his son to have as rounded an education as possible. So he ensured that he played many sports and enjoyed them. He got him to read widely. He developed a very deep appreciation of music, of a whole lot of different kinds of music. And he was incredibly encouraging to his son. He hoped, I suppose, that one day his son might also study medicine, and whether he went into pathology or another area of medicine would be his own choice. But what transpired was that his son did not manage to make the grades in college, and so he had to look at a different kind of career. And he went to a university to study philosophy and literature. And the father was quite happy with that. In the second year of his study of philosophy, he decided to change streams and to look at religion. That was one of the subjects on offer. And in the course of looking at world religions, he developed a very deep interest in Christianity, about which he had known nothing at all, never been in a church. And as this fascination with Christianity developed, so his commitment to Jesus developed, and he joined a church. And then a few years later, he felt that he should tell his parents what he believed his life was about. So one day he said to his dad and mum, I think that I should tell you now that I have applied to the church to be accepted as a candidate for ministry. I believe that I should be a pastor. Whereupon his father said to him, that is a waste of a magnificent brain. And that was the last word that he heard from his dad. His mother just smiled but said nothing. And thereafter, his father never inquired after his course, never offered a word of encouragement. When he was ordained, he went to the church where he was being ordained, and twice after that, in the next 10 years, he appeared in this church, but he always sat at the back, and from the beginning of the service to the end, tears rolled down his cheeks. Now, this is a puzzle. Why should this man be so antagonistic about religion? And why should this man be so dismissive of his son's conviction of what should be his vocation? Alan had no clue at all until, in the final days of his father's life, he said to him, aged at that time over 80, "What was it about the God thing?" And his father said, "It had nothing to do with you, and I have to ask your forgiveness. But when I was a child, I was an orphan, and I was reared in an orphanage. Between the ages of 10 and 14, every Thursday, I was systematically sexually abused by two men. And I decided that if ever I got out of this orphanage, I would have nothing, nor would my family have anything to do with God or the church, ever." Sometimes we hide the motivation behind excesses of affection or of condemnation. It's the kind of thing which we see and identify quite easily in our children when they become very excited about something and they will talk about it from what looks like a very plausible angle. You might have a niece or a nephew or a son or daughter or grandchild who says, "I think we really need a new computer in our house." And you say, "Why? The old one's working well." "Oh, yes, but you see, I'm thinking that when I go to college, I want to study astrophysics. And I don't think this computer was kind of geared up for that kind of advanced learning." And you say to this young relative of yours, "Now, is that true? Or is it the case that your best friend has just got a new computer and you want to be upsides with her or him? Or might it be the case that you saw a computer advertised the other evening in television and there was a free iPod and iPhone with everyone purchased?" And then you kind of expose what their true motive is, and their argument begins to collapse. We identify that in our children. But sometimes we ourselves hide our motives for expressing something which is either deep with enthusiasm or is high in its condemnation status, because we fear what people would think if we exhibited what our true motivation or our true motives were. We might lose their favor, or we might feel ourselves very vulnerable. And whether or not we can fool other people, we can never fool Jesus, which is what Simon discovered on the day that he, a Pharisee, invited Jesus into his house for a meal. Now, you'd think that somebody would say to Simon, "Simon, you have to understand, you're inviting the wrong person to have a meal with you," because he doesn't have a good relationship with Pharisees. Sometimes he says things which are quite outrageous. He might even end up calling you a snake. So you have to be prepared for that kind of thing. But Simon brings Jesus in. And as they're sitting, not in the middle of their circle, but from behind, as David indicated, in comes a woman who probably may have looked like and had the reputation of being a hooker. And she begins to bathe Jesus' feet with her tears and to dry them, a very sensual thing, with her hair, and to anoint them with a precious ointment. And Simon suddenly begins to be very angry at this and begins to belittle the woman and to express some kind of resentment at Jesus. And then Jesus challenges him. What are the motives for this antagonism which he is suddenly feeling and showing? Why is it that he is so upset? Why this kind of moral indignation? And he says to Simon, you know, normally when I go to a house, people give me water to bathe my feet because it's dusty outside. You've never done this. And this woman has washed her feet with my tears. Normally when you go to a house, people embrace you, they give you a kiss of peace, they're Jews. And you didn't do that, and she has kissed my feet. Sometimes when you go somewhere, they give you some oil for your head, just to refresh you, and you don't do anything like that. And she has anointed my feet with precious ointment. But maybe there's something more. Maybe Luke doesn't perhaps say everything that may have been in Jesus' mind. Maybe Simon wanted Jesus there because as a Pharisee, he was wanting to collect evidence which would ultimately lead to Jesus' assassination. Maybe he was hoping that Jesus would say something about the law which was improper according to the understanding of the Pharisees, and they could nail him for this. Maybe he was hoping that Jesus would infringe one of the regulations about how you wash your hands before you eat, and if he didn't do that, that would be further evidence that he was being untrue to his tradition. Maybe Simon, on the other hand, was thinking, if he is who he says he is, if he is the Son of God, then if I have him for a meal, it might mean that I will be favored at another time. Whatever the motive is, Jesus challenges Simon. Because as long as he is expressing antagonism towards somebody who's doing a charitable action, then he'll never be released from his bondage to the gnawing hidden thing within him until it's challenged, until he begins to expose himself to the truth rather than try to hide the pretense and the lies. When David earlier showed you, or on the screen that showed a picture of the abbey where my community has two residential centres, that's the place to which people come every year for a week to visit, to come to a conference. But we also have people who come for 6 weeks to be volunteers on our staff. And then we have people who come for 3 months or for 9 months or longer, and they are permanent members of staff. And sometimes when these people apply and you ask them, why do you want to go to Iona? You know, it's about 7 hours by 4 different forms of transport from Glasgow. Why do you want to go? And they say, well, it's because I think that God is calling me to spend some time in his service in a remote Hebridean island. And I feel like saying, you should see a psychiatrist. You know, in the winter, the rain is horizontal. You'd have to believe in God to want to stay in a place like that. And they will give other reasons about how they feel that their spirituality will somehow be liberated or that their sense of devotion to God will be exalted. And then after 2 weeks, these people discover the real reasons why they came. Because they thought their marriage was breaking up and they'd give their partner a rest. Or because they fear that they have an illness, and rather than go and have it investigated, they go to a remote island. Or other reasons which, once they are exposed and dealt with, then people, in being honest, become true to themselves and helpful for others. But as long as they are pious jerks concerned with their own spiritual piety, they are of no use to anybody, and they very quickly begin to condemn everyone else who is not as religious as them. And Jesus does not want people to live out of a motive which they haven't admitted to. And he exposes Simon to himself, not out of punishment, but because he wants desperately to liberate Simon from the mistruth, the misapprehension, the pretense which he has exhibited. There's a poem by Robert Burns, which I'll have to read because I don't remember all of Burns' poetry. He wrote quite a lot. And this is a poem in which he is taking issue with people who condemn others. Then gently scan your brother man, still gentler sister woman, though they may sometimes do what's wrong. To err is always human. But one thing rarely comes to light, the moving why they do it. And just as lamely can you mark how much perhaps they rue or hate it. For all we know, Simon might have hated being the kind of person who was steeped in jealousy, who was jealous of this woman who had shown extreme kindness, as he may have been jealous of other people, because there was something in his past or in himself which he felt to be inadequate. And as long as he coveted that inadequacy, he would be unpleasant to other people around. And the gospel is not about condoning our pretenses. The gospel is about opening us up to the truth and knowing that God understands. Knowing that God understands. That God can forgive, but more than that, God understands what motivates us. And if only we can make that clear to ourselves, we'll be liberated to be generous to others. Now, I don't know what people in this church believe about heaven or hell, but I would imagine that Alan's father, of whom I spoke a while ago, might by some people be thought of as a man who, having disbelieved all his life and having made his son's life a bit of a misery by refusing to acknowledge his vocation, may have gone from this life to the next and found himself condemned by the Almighty. I don't believe that for a moment. I don't believe that he's destined to be spit roasted in hell unto eternity. Because I believe that God is big enough and Jesus has been human enough to know that anybody whose life has been racked by the painful memory of sexual abuse for 4 years maybe has a reason to hate religion and religious people and even God. And in the mercy and providence of God, which is beyond our understanding, Alan's father might know now that he is fully known and understood and reconciled and forgiven. There's a kind of coda to that story about Alan, which is quite surprising. I mentioned that when he said to his parents that he felt called to the ministry, his father said, "It's a waste of a magnificent brain," and his mother just smiled. The reason for her smiling is this. One evening, when she was about 19 years of age, she was on a bus in Glasgow going to a meeting to help her decide whether or not she should become a deacon of the church. She felt that a calling on her life. And as she was traveling on the bus, there sat next to her a man in army uniform who had just come back from his time in national conscription. And they talked very amicably to each other all the way into the middle of Glasgow. He took her to the place where the meeting was happening, and when she came out 2 hours later, he was still standing there and walked her home. This was the man who'd become Alan's father. And they, the two of them, got to know each other very well and fell in love, and he proposed. And before she accepted, he said, I have to say this to you, that if you become my wife, then we will not get married in church, and there will be no mention of God or church or religion any time during our life. So she forsook what she believed she should do, and she married this man. And she conceived and brought into life her child, Alan, in a hospital in Glasgow. The day after his birth, an Episcopal priest was coming through the ward and noticed this young mother, who looked incredibly sad. So he went over and spoke to her, and she broke down. And he said, "Have you had a difficulty with the birth?" She said, "No, I've got a magnificent baby boy." So he said, "Why are you so sad?" And she told him the story of how it would be impossible to have her child baptized or blessed in the church, because she, who once thought she'd become a deacon of the church, gave that up when she got married and promised her husband that there'd be nothing to do with religion in their marriage. So the Episcopal priest asked a nurse to bring the baby, who would be called Alan, from the nursery next door. And he had some oil with him, and he opened the container in which there was the oil, and he made the sign of the cross on Alan's brow and said to his mother that God would never let a vocation go to waste. And 27 years later, without any knowledge that this had been done to him as a baby, Alan told his parents what he believed his vocation to be, and his mother smiled because the promise had been fulfilled. The motivation of God and of Jesus is always grounded in love and in justice, and always bears fruit which is loving and just, through which God's kingdom is manifest among us. Thanks be to God. Amen.